Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I am, as always, Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me today we have special guest Ben Davies. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Now, our usual format for this, or it has been for the last few podcasts, has been our 15-minute frenzies, whereby our guests, we take 15 minutes to be grilled on any topic of their choosing. Today you have decided to be grilled on which topic?
I'd like to look at Shakespeare in context, so the relationship between what Shakespeare's doing, writing about, specifically 1604, in the year 1604,
right,
and what was happening in England at the time.
Right, so what we're doing is we're taking literature and we're going to find out perhaps where some of the roots of that literature might lie in terms of history.
Absolutely, yeah, what Shakespeare's writing about is influenced by events at the time and the relationship between these two things.
Fantastic. So if we just say that, if I just give a little bit of context to this, we're talking about, you mentioned 1604, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so this, in terms of 1604, what's happening, just for our listeners, is that in 1603, Elizabeth dies and she does not leave any heirs to the throne, as a result of which we end up with a Scotsman on the throne of England. James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England. So this is the environment that we are throwing Shakespeare into, and you're going to discuss Shakespeare's Macbeth and King Lear.
That's right. I mean, you know, as you probably know yourself, this period in English history was not a particularly stable period, and it's considered to be one that there was, you know, much conflict at the time. And, you know, is it a coincidence that two of Shakespeare's darkest tragedies, most depressing tragedies, are written in this year? I don't think so.
Okay, so what we'll do is I'll start the 15-minute timer, but right at, just before we get into that, I'm just going to ask you one question. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to give your best explanation as to why we are talking about this in the first place.
Because fundamentally, I think it's fascinating. People out there might be thinking, you know, you might like literature, you might like history, and often never the two shall meet. But actually, I just want to get an insight into how important history is in the construction of literature, especially looking back on it, you know, 400 or 500 years later, as we are now doing.
Okay, brilliant. Right, I'm just about to start 15 minutes, and we're going to start right now. So you've told us the why you are interested in this, because it's important that we see this link between literature and history. How would you introduce a topic such as the contextual links between the literature of Shakespeare and the historical environment? What is it about this that the audience should know?
Well, I think, you know, if you look, Macbeth is one of, if not the most famous play that Shakespeare has ever written. And people may not have seen the play, studied the play, but they could probably tell you elements about the play. So, you know, why? What is so important about this play beyond just the you know, looking at it from a literature perspective? Well, there's some really interesting things in the play that relate directly to what's happening at the time. So, for instance, if I gave you The Witches, for instance, is that a good place to start?
It would be, but just for a second, before we get to that, could you just give... I read Macbeth a long, long time ago. Can you give our listeners who may not be familiar with it, just is it possible to give a brief overview of Macbeth?
Very, very simply... I'll do it as quickly as I can. There is a lord in Scotland who sees and meets up with these witches. They give him a prophecy. The main prophecy is that he will become King of Scotland. The King of Scotland, Duncan, is already on the throne. In the end, he feels the only way to do this is by killing the king. So he plots with his wife, Lady Macbeth, to kill the king. The king visits, they kill him. He takes the throne. And from there, disaster strikes. And obviously, being a tragedy, it ends in a particularly bloodthirsty and terrible way for him.
Right. Okay, so you very nonchalantly said that Macbeth, he just bumps into some witches.
Well, essentially, yes. He meets them out on the hearth.
Right.
And that's important, the fact he bumps into them. Their appearance is meant to be supernatural,
yes,
as it's almost appearing and vanishing into thin air. So that really firmly establishes the idea that these are supernatural beings and creatures.
Right, okay. So because you're about to talk about witches, is this a particularly religious time that we're talking about historically?
Yes. I mean, as you know, We've had the sort of tug of war between Catholicism and, you know, early Protestantism, if that's the right word. Yes. I'm not sure it is. Amongst the backdrop to this, just one of the things I was going to add is that, I think the year before, is that right, the gunpowder plot had taken place?
It takes place in 1604.
In 1604. Now, prior to the gunpowder plot, there was another assassination attempt on King James's life. So, you know, he's writing this play and the idea of where there is direct challenges on the authority and the life of the king.
Right.
Now, it's important in the play that someone who does this only comes to a tragic and destructive end, okay. You see. So that's something that's quite important, I think, in there.
So can I just clarify here? William Shakespeare is writing at the same time as James is on the throne.
Correct.
And the transition from Elizabeth to James, yeah. It has taken place.
Absolutely. And you've got to remember as well that when these plays are being first performed, Macbeth and King Lear, the first performance is not in the Globe Theatre. It's in the palace that James... resides in London. He sees the first, ever performances here. Now, the issue with that is that if something was to take place that he didn't like, undoubtedly Shakespeare would be in prison. He wasn't the only playwright at the time who never spent time in prison.
Right.
But there have been others around the time who either were put into prison or got into trouble for writing things that were,
politically sensitive.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So it's important that his plays... whilst he does challenge some ideas at the time, ultimately they have to conform to political expectations.
Okay, so let's get back to the witches here. How is it that the witches are relevant, or how is it that they are linked to what is going on in England at the time?
Well, the big thing in the play is that this idea about fate versus free will.
Right.
So the witches are shown, you can... watch it with essentially an open mind. Many people watch it and see this idea that essentially the witches control the play, everything happens is fated.
Right.
Other people suggest, well, there's a complexity there that suggests free will is very much part of it. You know, Macbeth chooses to murder Duncan. He isn't seen to be out of control when he's doing it. It's his decision.
Yes.
Now, at the time, people genuinely believed that witches had... existed with the ability to control other people. So much so that the famous witch trials are well known.
Yes, Salem witch trials.
Salem witch trials, other witch trials in there. But interestingly enough, James I was fervently interested in the pursuit and identification of witches. He even wrote, documents about his experience.
So what you're saying is that James I actually believed that witches existed at the time?
Yes. Now, interestingly enough, he believed in it, but he was slightly strange in that he believed in it, but he also believed that many people were not witches as well, were either imposters or fakes.
Right.
He felt that this was something that he took great sort of interest in proving personally that people who claimed that they were possessed and were therefore, I suppose, what you'd call witches, were not. They were imposters.
Right.
Because he felt it was very... And that was not because he didn't believe. He did believe, but he didn't believe it was ubiquitous in society at the time.
Okay. So his belief in witches, was it a positive belief or a negative belief? Let's say the witches that he actually believed were real witches. Did he believe that they were dangerous, or did he believe that they were a positive thing?
No, he believed they were dangerous.
Right,
they were essentially instruments of the devil.
Right.
But I think that, what you're doing, I think, is you're saying that if witches exist, they essentially have great power, to control people. I think it would take away from it if you had all these people who claim they were witches,
yes,
yet couldn't demonstrate their power and their ability to possess. So
okay.
To him, that was very... very important. He was extremely superstitious in this regard.
So does that mean, did his belief in witches and his view of witches as malevolent architects of fates, does that come from his Protestant religion, and is it engendered by the extreme Protestantism that was a key feature of England at this time? Because as you mentioned earlier, there was a real battle between Protestantism and Catholicism.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And I think his sort of Scottish roots are important. And I also think if you look at the British, you know, kind of going back beyond Christianity, going back further, even, you know, beyond or prior to even the Romans, there's always been this kind of belief in spiritualism,
yes,
that is outside of Christianity, and I think that there's elements of that in the culture, you know, that this this thing of witches and that is they've given it a Christian context, but essentially, you know, it comes from, if you look at historically, they've always existed in British culture,
right?
Or the belief in them and the idea of them has always been existent within British culture, you know.
Okay.
And I think it's something that they then apply to, I suppose, look through a lens of a Christian lens, allows them to kind of, you know, give it in their times a more modern context. But in my opinion, a lot of it relates to the historical relationship Britain has, you know, with things like druids and festivals and, you know, those kind of things. I think that what you look at is that actually Christianity evolved in tandem of those things. They weren't completely reduced from the culture.
Right.
The Christian holidays themselves in England are related to pagan holidays.
Sure,
they fall at the same time.
Saturnalia, I think, was Christmas and that kind of thing. We're doing well for time. We've got about 6.5 minutes left. Is there any truth to the suggestion that that James is Macbeth?
Well, no. It's
right.
That basically you will read on the internet that James is related to Banquo,
right,
who is the character who sees the witches with Macbeth.
Okay.
He has a prophecy that his sons will become kings, even though he won't.
Yeah.
Banquo is a real historical figure. He actually existed.
Okay.
I'm not so sure Macbeth existed. It's a very old story,
uh-huh,
that Shakespeare's kind of reimagined, which is what he did with all of his stories.
Right,
he rarely wrote any story out, any play that was 100% his own. He took stories, he took sources, and he turned them into plays with his own plot. Now, King James let it be known that Banquo was he was related to Banquo. It wasn't actually true. He wasn't actually related to Banquo, but he allowed the myth to be propagated that he was.
Who was Banquo?
I believe that Banquo was a Scottish lord who ended up becoming king and had a line of kings that came from him. So like a medieval Scottish king, essentially,
uh-huh,
I believe.
Okay.
I may not be 100% correct on that, but I believe that
was
the case. So James is related to, always claimed relation to Banquo. And the idea is at the end of the play, Banquo's son is still alive. He's there in the background. He is ready at some point to inherit the throne. And it is told that he will create a strong line of kings, which would have appealed
to James.
To James. I mean, the one thing I will say as well that is historically important, people believed in this idea of the great chain of being,
uh-huh,
that everything in life was ordered, and that the king was at the top of this order.
Yes.
And if you attempted to manipulate the chain of being, only bad things will happen. So that would be removing the king,
mm-hmm,
you know, because it is God who creates the chain of being,
okay,
no one else.
So this is where the divine right of kings fits into
this,
right? Yes,
absolutely. And the whole point of the message is that in this context of James, you know, living under threats to his life from largely, well, Catholic, plots against his life, Shakespeare writes this play where, you know, it is shown that only evil, by, you know, killing an innocent king, the king is shown to be perhaps naive, but essentially virtuous and, you know, trusting of his subjects, that only bad things happen as a result of this.
That's very interesting, particularly when you think about how James must have felt very, very insecure once he first arrived on the English throne. If we switch now, because we've talked about Macbeth, you also, I think, wanted to talk about King Lear in terms of historical context.
Well, I think that one of the big issues at the time that was going on was James wanted unification between Scotland and England.
Yes.
Now, people might think, well, hang on, he was king of both, so not an issue, but he was James VI of Scotland, in Scotland, as a separate country, whilst being James I, king of England. The two countries were not unified as one.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah.
He wanted them to be unified as one country. That was
his
big thing. There was stern opposition from it, because when he came there, he brought a lot of his Scottish lords with him to help, you know, to increase his power base.
Yeah.
But from a personal point of view, from him, he wanted it to increase his power base,
sure,
to be more powerful, to be king of a larger, you know, geographical mass, bring the two together. Now, interestingly, in King Lear, what the king does is he divides his kingdom up between his daughters.
Okay. Now, if I remember rightly, it's Goneril, Regan, and...
Goneril, Regan. I've forgotten, I've taught this.
He's drawn a blank, ladies and gentlemen.
This year. Cordelia.
Cordelia, that's it. Yes. And Cordelia's the good daughter.
Who offends him at the start, so he gives her nothing. But he splits his kingdom into two from one.
Uh-huh.
And the whole play, the whole tragedy of the play goes from that decision. Now, obviously, it's the kind of the opposite of what James wants to do. James wants to take two and bring to one.
Yeah.
The whole idea is that unifying as one is greater than none. And by the end of the play, someone else who isn't royal has assumed the throne.
Uh-huh.
Edgar, who is a good character, but he's assumed the throne as one country rather than two countries or two states as it briefly becomes in the play. That whole idea there is, I guess, Shakespeare promoting James's message,
right,
that unification is a good thing, separation is a bad thing.
So Shakespeare would have been very well aware of these concerns, these
absolutely
imperial concerns. Now, do you think, therefore, that he was writing to somehow either suggest or just to placate the thoughts?
I think if you look at Shakespeare, it's very clever because he gives all different viewpoints within his play, because they're from different characters.
Right.
So if you have a controversial character, well, he can end up getting killed.
He can write
against that. So it kind of solves him. There is no doubt that whatever is performed, overall, James had to like it, had to be part of it.
Right.
Shakespeare is suggestive. I mean, you could argue that, yes, King Lear, the division causes the tragedy. But Lear shows hubris and vanity at the start of the play in dividing his kingdom up.
Right.
But that could just be a criticism on those things generally.
But that would not have been lost on James, do you think? That the message is combined and not dissected.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's very important that he has those, you know, the big message of the plays has to be unified with the thinking at the time.
Right.
So obviously, regicide ends with, death for those who commit it. The separation is a bad thing, causes tragedy.
Yeah.
Which therefore the subtext is unification is a good thing. But he does it cleverly because it's a fictional play in time.
Of course.
He's not saying it is England. England is, even though it's an old, ancient England in the play, almost a timeless England. And it works really well, you know, allows them to do both, essentially.
Just very, very quickly, we only have a few seconds left. If the witches are perhaps representative of the elements of spirituality and religion of the time, is there anything within King Lear that is also representative? Are there any characters like the witches that kind of represent
that? There is, it's not so much supernatural, but the argument of fate versus free will is really, really big. But it's staged in a pre-Christian time.
Uh-huh.
So there's lots of references to the gods and the gods being in control of and creating this sort of situation. The darkness of the play, Shakespeare's probably his bleakest play in many ways, relates to the darkness of the time of, you know, as well as what we're saying politically. There was also a reemergence of plague as well in that year, which had devastating consequences, obviously, for London. Although I believe that Shakespeare's borough, where he lived in London, was one of the lowest areas affected by the plague. For whatever reason, I can't remember what they think it is, but to do with death is one of the lower death scales. So death is literally all around, you know.
Would I be right? I'm trying to remember now my sixth form learning. With the storm, because he yells, "Rumble thy belly full," doesn't
he? Excellent. Yeah, yeah.
The storm would be the kind of the representative of representation of the problems to come should division occur.
Absolutely. It's metaphorical of bringing bad things, essentially. You know, the idea that without it, these things are, you know, going to happen.
Right.
You know, the bad things are going to happen, and the storm is a metaphor. Perhaps some people see it as a metaphor, actually, for the time.
Well, that brings us very, very perfectly to the end of the 15 minutes. That was fantastic. But if you have, or you had, 30 seconds just to somehow grab the listener, to somehow sum up what you've just said about the historical and contextual links between Shakespeare's Lear and Macbeth and the environment in England, Scotland in 1603, 1604, what would it be?
That's a very difficult question, but I'll try my best. In 30 seconds, I would say that if you delve deeper into the literature, into the words, there's something deeper going on there, something important going on there. And the bleakness, the main point I've been saying again, is the bleakness and the horror of these tragedies accurately reflect the bleakness of society at the time, because it was in many ways fighting against a deeply unpopular king who at times tried to manipulate his own image for popularity, because he knew without the popularity, without popularity and approval from the people, eventually, you know, his fate could go the same way as some of the characters in the play.
Fantastic. Well, that some wonderful knowledge I had absolutely no idea about. A lovely crossover between literature and history. Thank you very much for being our guest, Ben Davies.
Thank you very much. An absolute pleasure.
This is Versus History signing out. We will see you next week.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe, visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.